Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. And welcome back to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland. Today we'll be talking to Dr. John Hartigan about his new book, Shaving Beasts, Wild Horses and Ritual in Spain, a vivid first-person study of a notorious equine ritual from the perspective of the wild horses who are its targets. Wild horses still roam the mountains of Galicia, Spain, but each year in a ritual dating to the 1500s called Rapa das Bestas, villagers herd these beasts together and shave their manes and tails. Shaving the beasts is a first-hand account of how the horses experience this traumatic rite, producing a profound revelation about the durability of sociality in the face of violent domination. John Hartigan Jr. Constructs an engrossing day-by-day narrative chronicling the complex, nuanced social lives of wild horses and the impact of their traumatic ritual shearing every summer. His history generates intimate individual portraits of these creatures while analyzing the social practices like grazing and grooming that are building blocks of equine society. Shaving the Beasts culminates in a searching portrayal of an inspiring resilience these creatures display as they endure and recover from Rapa das Bestas. Turning away from thick description to thin, Hartigan moves towards a more observational form of study, focusing on behaviors over interpretations. This vivid approach provides new and important contributions to the study of animal behavior. Ultimately, he comes away with profound, penetrating insights into multi-species interactions and a strong alternative to human-centric ethnographic practices. John Hartigan Jr. is a professor at the Department of Anthropology and director of Americo Paredes Center for Cultural Studies at the University of Texas, Austin. His most recent book include Care of the Species, Races of Corn, and the Science of Plant Biodiversity, and Aesop's Anthropology, a Multi-Species Approach. Well, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. So I would like to start by asking you a question about your response to the current situation we're living in. So we have the pandemic going on. And could you just describe how has it impacted you and your work?
Yes. Well, it's been disorienting, certainly, but mostly in terms of teaching. My research was all completed prior to the epidemic, but it's impacting my ability to do some new projects, which, perhaps we'll talk about at the end of the show. In terms of this book, what was quite surprising to me about the pandemic is the concept of social distance. It was something I had been writing about when I was doing the analysis for the book. Horses have a very keen sense of social distance too. And it really made me think about how this is a broad problem for social species in general, how they work out attraction, repulsion, and alignment. So all of the, you know, strictures around social distancing and the efforts to distinguish that from, say, physical distancing, you know, trying to keep sociality intact in spite of all that. And then just the manifold ways that our reliance now on forms of mediation to socialize just makes so palpable the importance of these kind of micro level interactions that, you know, fall by the wayside when we're in a digital medium. All of those are key to sociality, not just in our species, but other species.
This is very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. So as you mentioned, the horses are just social animals, but do you think that they mostly rely more on a decentralized system to the social distancing, whereas as we've seen in the pandemic, we have to really focus our efforts to organize these efforts?
Oh, yes, absolutely. All of the other species are decentralized. Their forms of sociality don't involve institutions. But what is striking, so there was a couple of incidents very early in the pandemic when some of the strictures were being lifted in the U.S., like permitting people to go to the beach or the park. And they kind of, you know, public health officials thought, oh, well, that won't be a problem. But then all of these people all did it at once. It was kind of a herd phenomena. And they hadn't quite conceptualized that this species dynamic of ours was going to play out even in these, you know, wide open spaces.
Yeah, very interesting. Can you tell us more about how you adapted your academic life and teaching or with regards to student interactions?
Yeah, well, all of our courses at the University of Texas are done virtually now. And at least over the summer, they had turned out to be an advantage. I found my typical summer offering that the students were engaging with the readings much more. And that's partly because they were all isolated at home and really didn't have a lot of other things to do. So the quality of the engagement kind of went up. And as well, I'm currently teaching a 300 student introductory course. And because I pre-record the lectures, I have the synchronous class time just devoted to questions. And I get far better questions, you know, more probing questions than I would ever do in a large lecture hall. So there have been some advantages pedagogically.
Interesting. Will you retain these practices after?
I'm thinking about how to do that, particularly with a synchronous session that's just devoted to questions from the students. I think they're much more comfortable doing that when they're at home and they don't have, you know, a room of 300 people around them. They're far more comfortable.
Excellent. That's really informative for us and especially for staff who are teaching in these times and maybe are finding it a little bit hard to coordinate. So let's talk more about you. So can you tell us how you got interested in studying anthropology?
Yes. Well, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and I, you know, that was in the 1970s, a very disruptive time. We had the kind of economic collapse. And also as a white kid in a predominantly African-American city, you know, I thought a lot about race, you know, how it matters in some situations and then seemingly not in others. So I was really kind of intrigued by social dynamics. You know, how do these things shape our identities? And I had a fortunate circumstance as an undergraduate at the University of Michigan to get involved in a semester-long student-faculty research project where I got to try out doing ethnography. And this was with a mentor, Katie Stewart, who had been doing field work in Appalachia, in the coal camps there. And she was interested in how people from that region had migrated to industrial jobs in cities like Detroit. So I was able to apply this anthropological perspective to circumstances that I was fairly familiar with. And that just gave me a great sense of the potentiality of cultural anthropology and ethnography to pose and answer interesting questions.
So you were already interested from a young age in these complex questions. And can you give a perspective whether mentors or your environment helped you to really realize that this is your field that you would want to continue within it?
Yes. Mentors played the key role. So after my undergraduate work, I went to get my doctoral degree at the University of California in Santa Cruz. And there I attended the History of Consciousness department, a very unique place. And my mentors were Donna Haraway and James Clifford and Hayden White. And each of them really helped me develop a theoretical orientation on the kinds of questions that I had. And without that, I really wouldn't have been able to do generative work.
Do you have any advice for the early career academic listeners?
I was pondering that, and I think it's difficult because disciplines are so different. But in my case, with anthropology, it really mattered to study something that I was already familiar with. That gave me a great advantage and great insights. Typically, people kind of get cast into projects that are very remote or which they don't have much familiarity with. And that can also, be generative. But in my circumstances, I see the value of starting with and returning to things that you are already familiar with.
Excellent. Okay, then this brings us right to the question about how did you come around to writing the book?
Yeah. Well, the sort of long version is I spent about 20 years as an academic working on race in the U.S. Beginning with questions of whiteness, how to objectify that, working through a kind of cultural history of a very loaded stereotype of white trash, then doing a media ethnography of what we refer to as our national discourse on race, our national conversation on race. And then finally, wrapping that up with a textbook on ethnographic approaches to race. So after about 20 years of that, I felt I had kind of, tapped out what I had to say and the kind of approaches that I could, formulate. And I started, casting about to, work elsewhere. And so I started thinking about working in Mexico on a genomics project there. I had, from my graduate training, some background in science and technology studies. So I was ready to kind of turn to looking at geneticists as a tribe, if you will. Very quickly things shifted. I shifted from working in Mexico City on a human genome project to working in Guanajuato on a maize genome project. And there's, a bit of background there, but, succinctly, I was drawn to the fact that both genetics projects were thinking in terms of race, that is, races of corn or maize. And I began to, shift my understanding of genetics. I thought it was mainly about humans, but most of genetics research is on non-humans, particularly agricultural species. So gradually my frame of reference started to change. And with race, we have these concepts like indigenous or native. I had always assumed that those were about people principally, but I came to recognize that those terms were applied to plants first and then applied to humans. So very gradually my focus on the human became destabilized, and that opened up great possibilities. So in the in my prior book, Care of the Species, it opens with ethnography of plant science in Mexico, and then proceeds to do a series of studies of botanical gardens in Spain, in Madrid, in Barcelona, and Valencia. And by the end of that ethnography, I've adapted the botanist techniques of description and observation, and I use them to constitute some of the plants as ethnographic subjects. I started, shifting from trying to understand the representations of plants in people's heads to then trying to understand plants from an ethnographic angle. And this is possible because plants are actually very social. But the limitation there is most of that sociality occurs underground in the rhizome. They exchange nutrients and communication back and forth. And as an ethnographer, that's inaccessible to me. So I started thinking about, how could I look at non-human forms of sociality among animals? And I had an initial idea about rewilding. These rewilding projects are kind of a very popular in Europe and somewhat in the U.S., an idea that you can take a species and kind of turn it loose in some relatively undisturbed terrain, and that gradually it will become wild again. And, very complex politics there. But as I was doing this, I had the great fortune of a graduate student in our anthropology program, Jaime Mata Maiguez, and he said, if you're interested in rewilding, and I was looking at horses in particular, he said, well, you really ought to go observe this ritual in my home, Galicia, Spain. And it's this Rapa das Bestas. I said, wow, Jaime, tell me more. And so, he explained it, and I was immediately intrigued. And so I got together some research funds that enabled me to go and do a kind of preliminary observation. And I said, wow, this ritual is going to let me pose and answer so many interesting questions about non-human sociality.
You described such a fascinating journey, how you arrived to this book. So it included quite a lot. It included science, genomics, then plant sociality, which is really interesting concept itself. And then it culminates in this really marvelous marriage of these societal and scientific concepts in a book. So then what inspired you to flip the narrative of the contemporary discussion of human anthropology from human-centric, what we're really used to more animal-centric point of view?
Yes, great question. I'll answer it in two ways. First, in the most immediate way, when I attended this ritual, so the Rapa das Bestas, this has been going on for at least 500 years. You have these, free-ranging horses that every summer are herded together. And as you said in the introduction, systematically sheared. In anthropology, at least in the U.S., we have a foundational text. It's by Clifford Geertz, and it's about the Balinese cockfight. So in Bali, where he did, field work, they have these, cockfight rituals in which, the people wager huge sums on them. And it's a foundational piece because Geertz says in it, it's not really the cocks that are fighting. Actually, it's the men. And so he means by that, you know, what's important here are the kind of representations of status among the humans. And the cocks are just this kind of medium by which human representation works. So I'm watching this, you know, ritual, which has many of the same features. There's a great deal of violence, particularly between stallions who fight. And I had the intuition that, well, I could invert Geertz's model. And instead of assuming that the horses are just this medium, I could actually look at their social structure and how it's impacted by this very traumatic event and make the horses the center of a ritual analysis.
Interesting. That's exactly what provides this unique perspective where you have to really step outside your own boundaries to really appreciate it. So do you think this reconceptualization of the way we place and think about ourselves, especially timely now during the times we're living in a pandemic?
Yes. You know, there's a couple of points here. You know, one is that the pandemic has featured a lot of kind of apocalyptic thinking about collapse, calamity, disaster, and, you know, a great deal of anxiety. But what comes through in this book is that, you know, when these horses are, you know, subject to, you know, intense chaos, their capacity for sociality endures and it re-emerges quite powerfully. So, you know, I think that speaks to our current moment. But I think more tangibly, you know, what people are sort of newly aware of is the importance of social interaction. When in so much of that now is occurring online or through digital mediums, we lose the ability to keep track of how others are paying attention to us and focusing on us, you know, through bodily gestures. And it makes kind of, you know, interacting so much more difficult. Well, those kind of micro interactions are crucial to human sociality as well as to all other, you know, social species. And so, you know, at this particular moment, I think that there's a broader audience potentially for this book because of this kind of new awareness of the importance of these nonverbal forms of communication.
Interesting. So from your perspective, do you think our species has the potential to employ new forms of this social interactions, which do not involve the face-to-face or micro gesture readings? That's something that we can really adapt with time. Or do you think we are more likely to go back to how it was rather than adopting new ways?
No, I think we're going forward inexorably. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's very evident in all of these in these algorithms and various forms of artificial intelligence, which are so capable of mimicking our communicative characteristics. You have these, you know, social bots that are able to engage in conversation and perform kind of, you know, what we call parasociality. They're sort of, you know, mimicking it. You know, that's only going to intensify. So we will need to be adapting to these very rapidly changing circumstances under which we socialize. We have, you know, so many more forms of mediation by which facial recognition is operating, but then also how we kind of polish up our digital image. And then the dominance that those polished forms take on. I anticipate we will have increasingly uncanny and alienating encounters with the modes of sociality that have been characteristic of our species as we, you know, go forward with, you know, greater forms of digitization.
Excellent. It's always good to hear that we have sort of plasticity and dynamics to employ the new ways and really, really adapt going forward. So speaking about rituals, that's exactly what you describe in a book. So what place do the rites and ceremonies have in the society at large and also on individual level? As you mentioned, we are more sequestered now because of the social distancing. And how does increasing interconnectedness challenge the perseverance of these practices into the future generations for people to go on?
Yes, excellent question. So in terms of the importance of ritual and getting back to your opening question, you know, the most profound impact of the pandemic for my students, at least in the spring, was that they were unable to participate in the ritual of graduation. You know, and it was, you know, very devastating for them. And, you know, it's a ritual that, you know, many of them, they would never have participated in it at the college level, but certainly at the, you know, secondary school or, you know, high school level. And it's a ritual that they probably didn't put much stock in because it's a ritual. But when they're deprived of it, suddenly its importance was intensified. And they recognized that these things are very effective in marking a change of status. So, you know, where that ritual might for, you know, the college graduation, where you, so, you know, I'm at a university that has about 50,000 students. And so our graduation each year is, you know, thousands and thousands of students, you know, broken up in these different schools. And it seems quite kind of a bureaucratic and administrative, you know, there's a long list of names being read as they go across the stage. It's sort of you know, kind of depersonalizing because of its scale. But then when you take it away, it's suddenly, oh, wow, that was very important and it matters. So ritual is something, you know, quite interesting in a couple of broad regards. One, all vertebrates have rituals. So if you have a backbone, a skeleton, you have rituals. So, you know, all of the, you know, primates and mammals, we like see them on the nature shows, right? They have these, you know, mating rituals, but these come in a variety of forms. And so with horses, they have a greeting ritual and a departure ritual in terms of their, you know, your signaling with whinnies and neighs, you know, okay, you're going, our relationship will be the same when we meet again, or you're arriving and it's the same. So ritual is a very powerful leveling analytic. It's something that accomplishes the important task of saying, okay, here's how we use it with humans and here's how we use it with non-humans. It allows that kind of intellectual movement to be very fluid. The second dimension is ritual was very key for the beginnings of anthropology. This was one of the things that anthropologists could very easily study, and where you have, in a sense, a whole culture on display. So, you know, think of like a harvest, you know, ritual, you know, the whole village kind of comes together and people are expressly stating their values. You know, we are engaging in reciprocal exchange of yams, you know, because we want to establish these kinds of ties. So it was foundational for anthropology. But by the 1960s and 1970s, it became subject to a lot of criticism. You know, one, because it looked at you know, these exceptional events instead of routine and everyday kinds of practices. But it tended also to emphasize elites, you know, those who were in control of officiating over a ritual. So it fell out of favor. Now it's coming back, or I'm certainly trying to, you know, do my part in revisiting it, partly because it's another way of thinking about non-humans in the human cultural milieu. So many rituals involve animals, particularly in forms of animal sacrifice. So, suddenly you can see, oh, wow, this form that we stopped paying attention to is actually a very powerful window, if you will, onto the ways humans constitute self and social relationships in and through and with animals.
Interesting. So you've put several points that I haven't actually considered, especially with regards to marking change of status of the events like ceremonies of the graduation, for example, but also the everyday routines that can bring solace and comfort to us every day. And do you think the loss of some of these are also contributing to this restructuring of how we view ourselves during these times?
Yes. The fundamental rituals, we all generally engage in begin in the morning in the bathroom, with the various hygienic routines by which we put together a self that then is going to go out to face the world. And it's a ritual because it's a stereotyped set of behaviors, but also an intense set of meanings associated with them. If I don't do these things, I will lose friends, I will lose my job, I will lose things, so it's meaningful. When those personal rituals then don't have the kind of follow through of actual social interactions where the presentation of self can be affirmed by others. And that's something I'd like to get back to, in a few minutes. Then those rituals become more a source of anxiety, perhaps, than the assuasion of anxieties, which is basically what rituals should achieve.
So speaking of the rituals on small society level,
yeah,
I have been a horse riding instructor for a while, as part of my career, and I can tell you firsthand that shaving a horse is not an easy task. So especially if you've got a herd of wild beasts. So how do you think is it possible to keep this tradition going and this technical aspect of the whole society coming together every year and performing this spectacular action?
Yes. Okay. Very good question. A couple of things to respond here. There are at least a dozen of these Rapa das Bestas across Galicia. To one extent, they're very vulnerable to social and economic change. So the practice of shearing the manes, for instance, had a material component. That horse hair could be used to braid rope, to provide filler for mattresses, or even to help support plaster walls. Well, all of those uses get replaced with synthetic materials, roughly 1970s, 1980s. So, so there's a loss of value there. Importantly, this is a rural practice, and the rural portions of Spain have been emptying out over the last several decades, as they are in many Western countries. So the people who have been doing this, who have learned it and had it passed on through generations, it's very precarious whether they'll be able to pass it on to subsequent generations. At the same time, though, what you can see in Sausalito, where I worked, and in several other of these sites, people who are engaged in this ritual are thinking in terms of what we call heritage tourism. So where tourists are drawn to see these kind of historical forms of rural labor being performed. And in Sabuseto, it's enormously successful. They get literally tens of thousands of people there every year. And some of them are, you know, people returning to the village that where they grew up or where their parents still live. But many more are coming who had no attachment to the place. And to that extent, you will likely see these rituals continuing because they are a form of kind of, you know, economic livelihood. You know, a lot of money pours into the area. And then one third dimension. So this, you know, population of horses, quite intriguing. They're diminutive. They're smaller in stature than typical horses. They are in this remote locale. And some zoologists think that this is perhaps a refuge population from before the last ice age. So they were probably skipped over by a lot of the domestication practices. So there's a movement both in Spain and Portugal to turn this population into a breed. They're called Guaranos in Portugal and then Raza Galega in Spain. And so to the extent that this ritual gives a basis for heightening attention to these breeding practices, that also might keep it sustained, because in order to constitute this as a breed, they need both a distinct population and a kind of public acknowledgement or recognition that this is a distinctive form of the horse.
So do you think the loss of traditional practice of the ceremonies themselves, apart from this ceremony tourism, is sort of natural course of the evolution of the societies where the new rituals and ceremonies are being adapted?
Yes, basically. So, this is an important question because by the old economic system of rural life, these would die out. And, you know, they're also, I should note, threatened because many villagers would prefer to have the range populated by cattle instead, which is a lucrative, population in contrast to these horses, which really don't, you know, generate wealth at all. This is the means by which the population can be regulated enough that they're not considered too threatening to the like, cattle raisers, but then also, again, you know, calling attention to their situation in the mountains such that people can become kind of attached to them and say, okay, well, yes, you know, this is a charismatic species and we should, you know, help perpetuate it.
Excellent. Okay, so I would like to ask you more on the theoretical part. So can you give us a brief description of what is the multi-species social theory? And does it include all living ecosystems and could it be extended to inanimate matter?
Yes, this is a very important question. So over the last 10 years, roughly, ethnographers have been turning their attention to non-humans. Over this process, it's mostly been kind of a question of method and technique. You know, how do we include them? And the theoretical aspects have not been very, foregrounded. Or, you know, to the extent that they've been there, it's been about, how do we accommodate a humanistic frame of reference to incorporate these non-humans. What I'm working on is actually taking the social theory a bit more seriously by engaging with evolutionary theory. Now, these two branches of theory the emergence of social theory with Emile Durkheim and sociology in the late 1800s, it was predicated on the idea that human sociality sort of achieved a kind of escape velocity from evolutionary dynamics and strictures. So, and they base that in, you know, there are so many different cultural ways of doing things. It's obviously not all, you know, functionally determined by evolutionary adaptation. Our brain, our mind is, you know, far greater than what we would need just in kind of an adaptive sense. But what that forgets is what we have in terms of culture is evolutionarily conserved, you know, certainly from the primate lineage. You know, we have it because our evolutionary predecessors developed it, basically. And so that's what I want to focus in on, to get away from some of the emphasis in social theory on what makes humans distinct, like language, to instead think of, well, you know, what do we have in common with other social species? And that, you know, brings us back to these kind of fundamental importance of things like ritual, and then also this matter of social distance, working out attraction, repulsion, and alignment. How do other species do that? And how can we see that among humans? And this is something that, you know, gets some support outside of you know, multi-species work. With race theory, there's an increasing attention to what's called microaggressions. So these very subtle ways in a racial interaction, somebody can be, you know, disdainful or dismissive, or, you know, pejorative without saying anything explicitly, but through a series of kind of nonverbal gestures. So you know, that underscores what I think is important in engaging with social theory in this broader manner.
Excellent. And do you think that this multi-species social theory can be applied in the contemporary world where we grapple with some of the big issues, so like environmental challenges?
Yes. So I just wrote a piece on that. When we look at conservation movements, you know, what they often forget are the social aspect of species. So you see a lot of emphasis in conservation. Well, you know, we have to maintain genetic diversity. So when we're going to, you know, grab a bunch of individuals, you know, they're kind of thinking at that level. With, say, you know, a species like elephants, well, what matters very much are the matriarchs. The old females that have all the kind of knowledge of social relationships and the kind of skills to facilitate and mediate social interactions, well, they would kind of get left out if you're just thinking about reproductive populations. So what multi-species ethnography can do is bring a far more developed attention to animal cultures, the social dynamics of species we would like to conserve, and make a case for thinking about, you know, one, how to preserve their forms of sociality, but also to devise projects that allow that sociality to flourish and, in fact, be reproduced as much as the, you know, kind of a breeding core of a conservation population.
That's a great point, but it also puts across the notion of understanding our humanity as it is, and maybe being more humble when we look at these societies which are not human.
Yes. It's very well pointed. Good point. We're quite conceited. You know, we call it anthropocentrism. You know, we're completely unique. Well, all species are unique. you know, our version of uniqueness, you know, features language and, you know, our considerable material and political accomplishments, but that does tend to blind us to our commonality with these other species. And, you know, the fact that our livelihood as a species, by and large, depends on the thriving of so many other species, from the kind of microbial level on up. So yes, it is a way of kind of disrupting the anthropocentrism, which is a very devastating mindset at this particular time.
Excellent. Really fascinating topics. Okay, so I would just like to mention about the book that what really strikes me is the narrative that you employ in the book. You do an incredible work of placing your reader right in the middle of this action, basically blurring the lines between the observer and participator, then basically forcing the reader to arrive at the points you wish to convey in their own accord. So I see that this book is really wide, applicable for wide-ranging audience. What was your rationale for employing this type of storytelling?
Well, I'm glad to hear that it works in that manner. I spent a great deal of time writing and rewriting this, I'm not sure that the rationale was entirely clear to begin with. I settled a narrative as a structure, and that just opened up all kinds of possibilities. Your typical academic book is structured by an argument. So you have to get a set of concepts and introduce those and then kind of rigorously make everything fit into supporting that. A narrative in a kind of broader philosophical sense is, of course, an argument, but it functions much differently. It conveys more about a location, and it works to place a reader in a location, and arguably it gives you much more information. My process here was fairly complicated, though it's a pretty simple, you know, structure and read. I had to first learn how to do horse ethology. Chapter one explains how I participated in a field survey, fairly close to the site I ended up working in, and how I learned to, you know, do various kinds of sampling techniques. I learned to understand the horse ethogram. An ethogram is like a catalog of species typical behaviors, the type of things that you will see any species member doing. I had to like recognize this. I had to learn how to observe their social interactions. So affiliative behaviors where they're, you know, grooming each other, aggressive behaviors. I had to learn all this very quickly. And I realized that I would need to explain that to readers, and the most kind of economical way of doing that was just to settle on this narrative form. Here's how I did it: kind of day one, day two, day three, day four, and once I had that form, then it worked equally well when I set out on my own in the mountains above Sabucedo to observe the horses on the range apart from the humans. So I was able to then apply these ethological techniques. And yes, this matter of being a participant and being an observer, you know, very tricky to manage. But what I tried to do was make sure the reader could see what I was seeing. I said, okay, here's what I'm seeing. And then I structured it. All right, now that I'm seeing this, how am I thinking about this? You know, what am I anticipating, what's surprising me, etc. And then the third stage, when the roundup begins, then I become a participant with my conspecifics. I'm there with the humans herding up these horses I had just been observing. It's very disconcerting. But, you know, my participation with it is so different from, you know, my fellow humans because I was engaging in this work of observing how their band structure was impacted by this event. And it was so legible. It was very clear that when the different bands are brought together, they worked very hard at separating themselves and maintaining a boundary between each band. But then as the scale increases, as you get, you know, hundreds of horses brought together, that's no longer possible. And so, you know, that breaks down, and their ability to use social space as a kind of signifying medium that collapses. And then, you know, gradually over the course of 4 days, and here again, the like narrative structure is very useful. I say, you know, day one, here's how it starts the ritual. You know, by day two, all this is collapsing. By day four, wow, here it is re-emerging again. So that narrative form was very liberating, but also very generative. For me, as an academic, I never learned to write narratively. You know, I always assumed that that's like what novelists do. You know, so I had to learn a whole vocabulary for describing landscapes, hills and streams, etc. And to, mobilize that in some kind of coherent way, the like storytelling format just kind of worked quite well.
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the strengths, the ability to convey such difficult concepts to wider audiences. Okay, so just to round up the discussion, I'd like to ask perhaps the most obvious but complex and at the same time crucial question. So will we ever fully understand ourselves and our societies? And what do you think we need to do?
Yes, you know, this is something that we'll just perpetually, grapple with. I think that this is the value of anthropology. It's a way of attending to that question continuously. And what we find is, the answers change. It's hard to settle on something, comprehensive when we have these perpetual forms of change, like, digitization, as we were talking about earlier. But there is something when you look at a ritual like this. So, it's humans and horses, and it extends back probably thousands of years. And it's quite likely the way that domestication was first affected with the horses. This simple process by which humans walking out on the range, forming a cordon around the horses, and the horses could physically break through that with ease. But their sociality is such that they prefer to stick together regardless of the circumstances. And then so you see this ritual playing out as it has for centuries at least, the same pattern, and the horse sociality responds in the same way as the human does, and in the human sociality it becomes inextricable with that of the horses. This is a form of being, if you will. It's not a livelihood in the sense of an economic value, but it's a very powerful set of relationships such that these humans go up during the winter, during the spring and fall to just watch the horses. They're very entangled with them. So to the extent that we can see ourselves at the species level in these kinds of social entanglements, then I think we do get increasingly attentive to what is it fundamentally about sociality that keeps drawing us close together, but then at the same time creating all these problems of too close, and we're perpetually sorting out, not close enough, too close, but my favorite time for observing the horses, I would get to a band and wait until they started to nap. And when they nap, the group kind of constricts. They all move a little closer together. And then, you know, they're like napping. It's a contagious behavior for, you know, maybe 20 minutes. And then when they wake up, they start, oh, wait, you're too close, or I want to be closer to you. And they start, you know, pushing away and sort of realigning themselves. And that's when I could see their relationships kind of on display. So, you know, with that sort of almost primal, if you will, understanding of sociality, then I think we can kind of bring that to bear even as we come up with these very new modes of socializing in digital realms.
Fascinating. Just look, watching these dynamics and it's really beautiful. Okay, John, we've taken a lot of your time. So could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes, gladly. And two things. So one is a theory book. I conceive what I've written as a multi-species trilogy. So the first volume is Care of the Species, and that was ethnographic. The second volume is Shaving the Beast. The third one is just going to address the theoretical implications of all this. And I call it Social Theory for Non-Humans. And it's something that I'm kind of live writing online. There's a platform called Manifold, and it's available through this press, the University of Minnesota Press. And so I post installments of my theoretical writing, and I ask people to engage with that. And I'm explicitly trying to think how to meld evolutionary theory with social theory. But ethnographically, I already started a new project 2 years ago on bullfighting in Latin America. It's immensely popular in several countries, Mexico, Peru, and Colombia, and it's banned everywhere else in Latin America. And so I'm quite interested in the ideas of race around the bulls, razas de toros, much like with races of corn and races of horses as well. But then also there are these very interesting indigenous variations on the bullfight. So well, last summer I was at one in southern Peru where the bulls aren't killed. And it also takes place over several days. And they bring in, you know, different ranchers, cohorts of bulls. And they, you know, go out and kind of play with them, you know, play bullfighting, but they aren't killed at the end. And so I'm intrigued by those practices, and they're probably, you know, quite old. And then how, you know, what's the transitional moment when bulls become killable? And that has to do with breeding, when they begin to be bred for this ritual. And that's when they start talking about razas de toro, or, you know, races of bulls. So I plan to look at breeding, you know, ranches in Colombia, and then as well some of these corridas de toros or bullfights in Mexico as well as Peru.
These sound very interesting projects.
Thank you.
So can you tell our listeners, well, where can they find more information about the book and your work? So you mentioned Manifold.
Yes.
University of Minnesota Press.
Yes, yes. So if you just Google social theory for non-humans, you'll probably find it. You can go online at the press, and they have a link for this project. And mine is one of many. They have several dozen of these kind of books in progress, and it's a range from ebooks and what we call, you know, short books that are, you know, about 20,000 words, to this you kind of open source platform, my book Aesop's Anthropology was published through a Creative Commons license. And it's part of this Manifold Project, and several other university presses are participating with it, making use of that platform for their own publications. So that's a good place to go. I post a lot of my work on academia.edu, so people can get access to my writings there. And then, of course, the books, which are available through University of Minnesota Press, but then also other kind of, online book dealers.
Excellent. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. I really enjoyed our talk today.
Me too.
So do you have any last messages you want to leave our listeners with?
Not in particular, but if you're looking for a good narrative story about horses, this is it. Shaving the Beast.
Perfect. So the book is Shaving the Beast, Wild Horses and Ritual in Spain. Okay. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Galina. It was a fantastic conversation.
Pleasure. Take care.